Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
One summer, on a flight from London to Denver, I was so terrified by the turbulence that I asked the young man sitting next to me to hold my hand, and that's how we ended up becoming pen pals. For a while afterward, we exchanged email messages. He lived in Denver. I lived an hour north, and while I know this sounds like it might be the start of a love story, our connection was purely platonic. Eventually, we stopped writing. There's only so much you can say to someone when you live close enough to share the same weather. Now it's 6 years later, and he's come to mind again because I'm sitting inside my Dublin flat thinking about how to meet a man. I'm scrolling through a dating app. I'm still new to online dating and haven't found my groove. The problem is that I'm keenly aware of my age. I'm not old, it's just that I'm old enough. I can remember life before cell phones and the internet, and because I have an addiction to feeling wistful, I'm prone to thinking the pursuit of romance in those days possessed an attractive simplicity. In elementary school, we wrote notes that said, "Do you like me? Circle yes or no." Within minutes of delivering this note to your crush, you'd know where you stood. If he shrugged and shoved it into his pocket unread, you'd go cry your eyes out in the nurse's office. If he read it and smiled, you could expect to announce your new relationship status by sitting next to each other on the school bus. The world couldn't come to us back then, so we went to the world. Our destinies might wait beneath the strobe lights of the local roller rink or against the music box soundtrack of the summer fair. We looked for them at school dances and in the creaking bleachers of Friday night football games. The hand of fate felt more acutely at play. We never knew who was coming or how they might show up. My favorite romantic memories were born in such unexpected moments. There was the taxi driver I met on a college trip to Mombasa. We locked eyes in his rearview mirror. My friends and I invited him to join us at a bar, and when I hugged him goodbye later that night, the air smelled like honey and salt, and I felt a door closing on the prospect of a very different life. Later that same year, in a Paris bistro, a young man invited me for a ride on his motorcycle. I answered with the only French word I knew, oui. He sped us down the Champs-Élysées and around the Arc de Triomphe. I didn't know his name, but I clung tightly to him as April lights sparked on like stars in the blue French hours. There were no mobile numbers or social media handles to exchange. Goodbyes held finality, and if they hurt, at least they offered clarity. The ability to disappear was sometimes a gift. A doorman at an American hotel once asked me to dinner. The food was good, but there was zero chemistry, so I spent the rest of my stay leaving by a different door. Another thing about getting older, though, is that you can catch yourself being overly nostalgic about the past. I do miss certain things, but I don't want to make too much of them either. Anyway, if they'd been perfect, I might not be sitting in my flat above a churro shop, scrolling through a dating app. I'm growing more accustomed to it. I've had my share of rejections. I've also declined some requests, as I did with the man who sent me a message in which he sweetly called me Petal. "Why'd you do that?" a friend asked when I told him about it. "I wasn't sure I could live up to the hype," I said. "Oh, Elizabeth," he said, "that man would have brought you breakfast in bed for the rest of your life." Apparently, fate's still playing its hand, too, because you never know who's going to pop up on the app next. There's a local man who says his favorite pastime is trying to say over and over, "Irish wristwatch, Irish wristwatch." Another says his goal for the year is learning how to use the other three sides of the cheese grater. Then there's a third, a 40-something man with kind eyes. He says he's unusually good at catching things when they fall. I send that one a like, because we're all flying through space on this planet anyway, and the ride gets a little bumpy. Holding a friendly hand can be nice, but sometimes you just want someone to kiss you like your plane is going down. ¶¶
were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat.
Not long ago, a German lady named Beatrice Karsch, who is very dear to me and my family, died aged 98. The story of my connection with Beatrice and her husband, Hans Helmut, goes back to the Bay of Biscay. At the height of the Second World War, and a major international incident that has gone down in Irish naval history. On the 29th of December 1943, a small Irish merchant vessel named the Kerlogue, owned by the Wexford Steamship Company, was returning from Lisbon with a cargo of oranges when a German plane flew overhead signalling SOS and indicating the boat should follow it in a southeasterly direction. After 2 hours, Captain Tom Donoghue and his men came upon the appalling aftermath of a naval battle 500 miles northwest of Finisterre. A German destroyer and two torpedo boats had been sunk with most of their 700 crew drowned. The sea was littered with corpses in life jackets and men desperately clinging to wreckage. For 10 hours, in rough seas until after dark, the exhausted crew of the Kerlogue hauled men onto the small 140-foot craft. They rescued an incredible 168 men until Captain Donoghue issued the stark order, "No more or we'll sink." The crew distributed their spare clothes and gave what first aid they could. The cargo of oranges saved the survivors from dehydration. A crew member later wrote, "Cabins, storerooms and alleyways were soon packed with shivering, soaked and sodden men. Others were placed in the engine room, where it became so crowded that the engineer could not attend to his machinery." And so by signs, as none spoke English, he got the survivors to move the instruments he could not reach. Lieutenant Commander Kfadenfeld, the highest ranking German rescued, requested that the ship sail for France, but Captain Donoghue refused. The Germans could have easily commandeered the ship, but respected his authority. Donoghue also ignored orders from the British naval authorities to return to Fishguard and headed instead for Cork, where the survivors could be cared for. He sent the following message to Valentia radio station. "Proceeding Cove, expect arrive 2 a.m. tomorrow morning. Have on board 164 seamen, survivors, 7 men seriously injured, 1 man dead. Please instruct Port Control Cove that I request urgent medical assistance. Have no food, water or clothing. Thomas Donoghue, Master." Valentia acknowledged the message and signed off, "Well done, Kerlogue." Intercepting the message, the British authorities in Cornwall sent the following message. "Proceed direct to Fishguard in accordance with Navy Cert." The order was ignored by Captain Donoghue, who acted in the tradition of Admiral Nelson's blind eye and switched off his radio receiver. The Kerlogue berthed at Cove on the 1st of January 1944. The rescued Germans were interned in the Curragh military camp, where they enjoyed relative freedom until the end of the war. Conditions were comfortable. One internee wrote home, "The food here is beyond all praise. I don't exaggerate when I say that we get twice as much to eat as on board, meat in large portions, white bread and good butter, fresh milk and 5 cigarettes daily." Fast forward nearly 25 years, and this is where the Karsch family I mentioned earlier comes into the story. In 1968, my German lecturer at University College Galway wrote to his hometown newspaper, looking for families to host his students during the summer vacation. As a gesture of gratitude to Ireland, as it were, Hans Helmut Karsch, who had been one of those German sailors rescued by the Kerlogue, replied. And so began a wonderful friendship between his family and mine, which continues over half a century later. I spent my holidays in the northern German city of Nordhorn, where I attended the local gymnasium or secondary school. Hans told me about his time in the Curragh. He was a gifted artist and had painted watercolours of the rescue in the Bay of Biscay and the Curragh camp. He showed me with pride the identity card, which allowed him travel within a radius of 30 miles. Internees visited Dublin and went to the Curragh races, where they sold doughnuts baked on a turf fire at the camp. Some internees worked for local farmers, thinning beet, cutting turf and saving hay. They gained a reputation for repairing bicycles, clocks, and radios. They reared and sold rabbits and dogs. Some registered for courses at UCD and attended the graduation ball in the Gresham. 50 years after the rescue, 20 of the survivors and 2 of the British Navy officers who had fought against them visited Dunleary for a commemoration ceremony in the National Maritime Museum. A presentation was made to the last surviving member of the crew, Tom O'Neill. It was an emotional reunion with tearful embraces. The survivors visited the site of their old internment camp in the Curragh. They held a service at the grave of Captain Donoghue in Dungarvan. Tom visited Germany on many occasions as an honoured guest of some of the men rescued by the Kerlogue. The last time he was there was to attend the launch of a yacht owned by one of his hosts. She was named Kerlogue.
One of my fondest memories of my student days in Carysfort College is of the day our poetry professor, Seamus Heaney, discovered that I was from Wexford, and he told me he'd once sought out my family's neighbour in Kilmore, Mrs. Jeffries, to talk to her about the old Yola dialect. So I wrote this poem to remember Lizzie Jeffries, and with apologies to Mr. Heaney. One time, Mr. Heaney was at his desk, solid as the sugar loaf. Still cheerful after a day of lectures, his eyes crinkled with good humour under a ruffled mop of hair. And to put me at my ease, he told me that one time he had taken the time to drive down south to County Wexford and then further on to Kilmore to find a Mrs. Jeffries, because he'd heard she knew a thing or two about Yola. And as his northern voice rumbled on, I went astray, imagining the poet hunched up against the windscreen of his grey Volkswagen as it sputtered down the coast road. Wicklow, Arklow, Gorey, Ballycanoe, Castlebridge, over the new bridge, along the quay, around the crescent, through Madeline Town, to the Rosslare Road. Perhaps he got lost around Killinnick and had to pull in and ask if anyone knew of Lizzie Jeffries, All-Ireland ballad singer, keeper of the old stories, last speaker of Yola. Directed back to the Parton Roads, he trundled on to Randallstown, Tinacre, Gollock, Ballyseskin, past a skiock with its burden of wooden crosses, then left onto the Ballask Road, our road, to the first house on the right for tay with Mrs. Jeffries. She told him how we keeked around corners, kirked down to pull ingans, carried war from the strand, retired for our entite after a feed of bidets slammed with butter. We heached the pump, hatched round the half door, where queer yolks were often queer dull, and would ownshuck if the griggin went too far. And she would have mentioned the Normans, who gave us dark eyes and elegant French noses. The betrayal of Bagnall Harvey on the Salty Islands, where she and her sister picked bidets more than a century later, slept in the shed, sang of shipwrecks and lost sailors. Maybe she pointed down the road to Tom Haggard, advised him to see the thatched chapel and the mass rock in Devrix's field, where lives were lost to keep the faith. And as he was leaving, she would have pressed him to come back at Christmas, when 6 men rise to their feet at midnight mass to sing ancient carols and a garland of godly songs. I was still lost when the poet stood for me to leave. I never asked, too shy at 17, if that time when Heaney took the time to drive down south, if he ever found Lizzie Jeffries, queen of ballads, keeper of our stories, our Yola woman.
My next song is, it's a love song. It's about the maid of Ballygow. Ballygow is in the parish of Carrigambano in South Wexford. And this song was composed about a Kilmore girl that was at service in a farmer's place in Carrigambano. And this is how it goes. As I rode down to Cullen's town, all in the month of May, I roam for recreation to watch the ladies gay. 'Twas here I spied a lovely maid, and she standing on the brow, her beauty bright did me delight that day in Ballygow. I said to her, my lovely maid, you have bewitched me, and I would wish with all my heart that you would marry me. For no more I'd roam from Bano's banks, where the tide do ebb and flow, or sail the stormy ocean when the wintry winds do blow. And if you are a stranger, kind maiden, to me tell, is it on Bano's lonely banks your parents they do dwell? Sure, if you are a stranger, kind maiden, let me know, for the killing glances of your eyes have proved my overthrow. Kind sir, I am a stranger, and your offer I decline. For every lad that sailed the sea, do ever with the wind, and every girl that they will meet, to her let's swear and vow, and leave you to mourn them, said the maid of Ballygow. I said to her, my lovely maid, you have bewitched me, and I would wish with all my heart that you would marry me. For no more I'd roam from Bano's banks, where the tide do ebb and flow, or sail the stormy ocean when the wintry winds do blow. So farewell to Bano's lonely banks, the place that I love best. And likewise you, fair Ballygow, for I'm bound to the west. I pressed her to my bosom, and I kissed her burning brow. For now I'm on the ocean wide, and she's in Ballygow.
The music journalist David Hepworth makes the bold claim that 1971 was the greatest year in the history of rock and popular music. And he argues that, for those who were listening, it never got any better. Well, for me, it did get better. 1974, the year I did my leaving certificate, 50 years ago, was the year when music poured into my life. It wasn't that there was no music in our house, there was. It just wasn't the right kind of music for me. My mother loved Mario Lanza and Broadway musicals. Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel was a particular favourite, as was Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady. My older sister introduced Gilbert and Sullivan into the mix. One brother, 8 years my senior, was into American swing and liked to play Glenn Miller's In the Mood on accordion or piano. He also loved the close harmonies and lush orchestrations of the Ray Conniff Singers. My brother, next in age to me, struck out on his independent track. He was a balladeer, plain and simple, Irish ballads only. I wanted to forge my own identity. This, after all, was the era of Ziggy Stardust, of Rebel Rebel. But I was compliant and obedient and far too well behaved to be a rebel. The nearest I got was advocating for the eponymous Sweeney's Men album, with its mixture of American, English and Irish folk songs, and arrangements which featured mandolin, bouzouki and 12-string guitar. But this was a half-hearted rebellion at best, and went totally unnoticed in my household. And then I got a job in Winston's department store at the weekends, and saved enough money to buy myself a new outfit. Light blue, bell-bottom jeans, round-toed patent leather shoes with platform heel, and a purple round-collared shirt. And for good measure, I had my hair styled in one of the first unisex salons in Dublin. My father really was in a whirl and was not sure if I was a boy or a girl. I might have carried off this style had I been a slim-hip David Bowie or an androgynous Mark Boland, but I was a hefty lump of a young fella from Crumlin, and pretty soon I realised how idiotic I looked. And then I did find a style of sorts, desert boots and beige cords, with brown velvet inserts sewn in by my mother, and a red waistcoat made from coarse felt, and embroidered with a mythological Inuit owl, a spirit guide for the souls of the dead. All I needed now was the right music to go with this fresh look. And then, as if by miraculous means, I found it. My Gilbert and Sullivan sister, and my American swing brother, befriended a medical student and his girlfriend through part-time work in the catering department of Trinity College. Paul had grown up in Africa. Bertha came from California. They glowed with health and energy in the way that Irish people don't or didn't back then. They were sun-kissed, beautiful, and in love. And one evening in 1974, I found myself in the company of my sister having supper with Paul and Bertha in their flat near Mountjoy Square in Dublin. The flat was wonderful, decorated with throws, rugs and wall hangings and Bertha's collages. The colours were vibrant. There was pottery from Africa and Mexico. We ate chili con carne and we talked. And they treated their teenage guest with care. They asked questions and responded with interest and curiosity. They encouraged my hopes and dreams. Their enthusiasm and optimism were infectious, as was the open-hearted and generous way they looked on the world. And then there was the music. Through supper, they played some of their favourite albums. And when I left their flat that night, I did so with a clutch of albums under my arm. Carole King's Tapestry, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Crofts and Seals' Summer Breeze. In the shed den in my home in Crumlin, I tried to recreate the ambience of Paul and Bertha's flat, and I played their records on my Bocketty record player. I'm sure they were scratched to bits when I returned them, but I'd found my music. Okay, it wasn't rebellious. In fact, the songs I liked most were low and intimate, mellow songs with sweet sentiments. It was not music to bring the walls of Jericho crashing down, but it was my music. Soon, following Paul and Bertha's advice, I was listening to Joni Mitchell's Blue and Neil Young's After the Gold Rush, and I swapped my Sweeney's Men album for James Taylor's Fire and Rain. Paul and Bertha were a fleeting but luminous presence during a formative period in my life. They were the coolest and most generous people I'd ever met, and the gift of music they gave me has endured. 50 years on, I remember them with fondness when winter's closing in, and I see the geese in chevron flight, or when the year is warming up and the summer breeze is blowing through the jasmine in my mind. Thank you.
I awoke today and found the frost perched on the town. It hovered in a frozen sky.
For years, there's been an unspoken rule in our house that on Monday evenings at 8 o'clock, the TV would be switched to BBC Two. Dinner eaten, a cup of tea would be made, places taken on the sagging couch, as the chirpy, convoluted tune of College Boy plays over the title sequence of our favourite show, portraying figures of the past, different inventions and theorems. As the camera pans along, a voice declares, "University Challenge." Then, the courteous introductions of the hyper-smart students, preppies, hipsters and the captain, always third from the left. I would make a split-second judgment and pick a side. As a secondary school student with the leaving hovering into view, I tried to imagine what it would be like to sit under the glare of studio lights, having to not just know all this niche information, but be able to retrieve it at the speed of a finger pressing a button. When I first started watching the show, I'd sit and wonder, as some of the best students from the United Kingdom's universities were grilled on subjects that I had no idea about. The odd time, I was lucky enough to even understand the question being asked. The most I'd take part in was the picture round. But for the past two series of the show, my attention while watching University Challenge was heightened because I'd been set my own challenge by my ultra-competitive dad to beat him at this, his favourite quiz show. His record was 22 correct answers, so he was a formidable opponent, but I had noted that his performance could be inconsistent, week to week. Surprisingly, this challenge was a welcome distraction from my schoolwork and at times seemed to even complement it. The bombardment of poems, geographic processes, and French verbs coming at me in school all had the potential to crop up as a starter for 10. Every Monday, I'd join my dad in front of the TV to compete, never mind that I might have 2 tests the next day, a project due, and 3 essays to be done by the end of the week. I began to set myself easier challenges by taking my dad on in other shows, such as Mastermind. The general knowledge round usually holds a fair mix of questions for the pair of us, sparking ever closer battles. His weaknesses were my strengths. I actually understood today's pop culture and distinctly remember leaping out of my seat when I had the opportunity to answer questions on the Percy Jackson series, BBC Sherlock, or Harry Potter, as my father sat, mute. And when his answers came, sometimes more slowly than before, mine got faster. Knowing that I could complete the English Paper 2 for my junior cert without a dead hand afterwards, as well as 3 6-page Leaving Cert history essays in the space of 120 minutes, really boosted my confidence. By the start of sixth year, my dad began to realise his days as the self-proclaimed King of University Challenge might be numbered. It wasn't all about accumulating precise facts either. As I got older and sharper, my hunches at answers began to produce results. Over time, patterns emerged. Any question on a German composer? Usually Beethoven or Wagner. British artist? Try Constable. A forefront political figure in Europe in the 1870s? Bismarck. An inexplicably complex sounding maths question? Best odds are to answer with a number between 0 and 4. Moreover, I had the upper hand on my father in science. I was doing honours biology. He failed lower level physics. But he was still holding his own. Agonisingly, one evening, I managed to reach a draw with him, yet still did not win. As my study for the Leaving Cert increased, my scores became increasingly erratic and often abysmal. Some nights, I managed merely 3 correct answers and started to think that maybe my chance had gone. But then, one inauspicious evening, I came home from school, a sixth year badly in need of a break. I sat down with my usual cup of tea, but it remained untouched as my 14 years of schooling culminated in correctly answering an almost unbroken run of questions involving quotes from Gerard Manley Hopkins and Macbeth, European tensions in the late 19th century, protein synthesis, and the physicist Richard Feynman. That evening, my best ever score of 16 was more than double my dad's pitiful 7. Victory. Vindication. The competition,
the drama, all came to an end at the sound of a gong. My dad, defeated, held back a tear of pride. The moment that I had waited for, and then realised he too had also waited for, had finally arrived. But that, and study for the Leaving Cert, are in the past. My results let me breathe freely for the first time in 2 years. All the work and all the learning, thankfully, rewarded. University place accepted. New questions are forming in my mind. In 4 years' time, will I still hold close the friends I hold so dearly now? What will I wear without the uniform I've worn day in, day out for the past 6 years? Who will I be? A hipster, a preppy, or some horrifying mixture of both? The safety and the security of secondary school now gone, I face into one of the greatest challenges I will ever face. University.
University Challenge. Asking the questions, Amol Rajan.
Hello and welcome to University Challenge, where two more student teams are about
on the road, but this time it's different. We've taken you on the road so many times. That first trip south, then west, to show you off to all the Kilkenny and Limerick clans. We've taken you on the road so many times. Great days spent on mica sparkling beaches, Lahinch, Clochmore, Fountainstown, Melk Harbour, or hide and seek in the dunes on Inch Strand. We've taken you on the road so many times, out of Dublin to the wild west of us. But son, this time it feels very different. Your da has packed and repacked the car, holdalls of clothes, a soap bag, bed linen, and the toolkit of an apprentice plumber. I stand in our driveway like a gobdaw, wanting to kiss every inch of your skin like I did when you were newborn. But I bite me lip and shut me mouth. I just hold on to your favourite pillow and take in deep breaths, the lovely smell of you. Your da clocks me, smiles and says nothing. You're oblivious, making last-minute checks on devices, recharges, playlists, downloads for student orientation, then Googling the Diggs address in Waterford. We've taken you on the road so many times, shown you the byways as best we can. Now we hope you'll make your very own maps and always, always find your way back home.
On this morning's programme, we heard Flying Lessons by Elizabeth Oxley, The Curlogue by Fran O'Rourke, One Time, a poem by A.M. Cousins, Summer Breeze, a musical coming of age by Kevin McDermott. My Pre-University University Challenge was by Jennifer Carey, and On the Road, But This Time It's Different, a poem by Rachel Hegarty. The music was Into the Mystic by Van Morrison. Two Reels, The Steam Packet and Miss MacLeod, played on Illan Pipes by David Power. From the RTE Radio Archive, The Maid of Ballygow, sung by Lizzie Jeffries. Urge for Going by Joni Mitchell. And the theme tune to BBC's University Challenge, College Boy by the Ballinescu Quartet. An exhibition about the MV Curlogue is currently on show at the National Maritime Museum of Ireland in Dunleary. See mariner.ie to book tickets. And Jennifer Carey's University Challenge essay is published in the latest book from this programme, Sunday Miscellany, an anthology from 2018 to 2023, which is published by New Island Books. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to the programme on the RTE Radio app or on the programme website.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.